Blog Talk Radio.
Subject areas. We'd like to have the caller views and perspectives on these issues as we discuss them, and we hope to learn something greatly from them so our people can come better informed and we can make better choices in terms of how can we move our people forward. So again, we welcome everyone to Africa on the Move. So at the first issue, which basically we'd like to talk about a recent event that took place in Richmond, Virginia on the 13th of August, 2014. The event was the Cuba's Appreciation Awareness Day. The theme was Cuba Changes, Realities, and Understanding. It took place at Wesley Memorial United Methodist Church, 1720 McKenna-ville Turnpike, Richmond, Virginia, 23223. Its invited keynote speaker was Alexander V. Rodriguez Salazar. He is the second secretary of the Cuban Interest Section. The brothers and sisters of Cuba was invited to come and speak to the African community in the Richmond metropolitan area and all people of goodwill. It was unfortunate that they was not allowed to attend. They did not receive permission from the U.S. State Department. So as a result of that, the movement kept going on. It didn't stop the nature of the event, which as a participant, I thought it was a great event. And what we're going to do right now to talk with the, to share with our listening audience some of the things that came out of the event and their perspective. They also were participants. We have with us Brother Haki from the African Awareness Association and Brother Neil Holmes from the Pan-African Unity Movement. And let me make sure I got that name correct, Brother Neil, because we're going to credit you with the correct organization.
Okay. That's the correct name.
Okay, good. Now, first and foremost, one of the major reasons why we're doing this is we realize the importance of Cuba in today's world. We know the world today needs Cuba. At the same time, we know Cuba needs the world. Now, I'll start with Brother Haki in terms of a general overview of the program. What's your makeup and take of the program in terms of its participation in the community and the dialogue that took place and the type of subject matters that were raised in the context of this question of unity between the Cuban Revolution and the African Revolution? Brother Haki, what's your general take?
I thought the program was very insightful. There was a myriad of perspectives from Cuba.
particularly when to focus on Cuba's contribution to humanity. There was a great contrast between systems. It's very, very clear in terms of the Cuban system, this whole notion in terms of the upliftment of humanity, the importance of sharing, the importance that systems or institutions play on shaping the mindset of human beings. All that stuff was contrasted, and I think that the audience was really appreciative of that. You know, a lot of things that they thought they knew about Cuba, they didn't. So they had an opportunity to learn a lot of new things about Cuba in terms of, you know, just how important Cuba is, not only to Africans around the world, but also to humanity generally. Cuba has a very humane system. Even though it doesn't have the highest per capita income, but it does use the resources to benefit its people. Contrast to America, which has an abundance of wealth, in which the wealth is skewed to the top 1%, which means most American people are, in fact, impoverished. And as a result of Cuba's stand on humanity, the resources that it does possess, it does an equitable job in terms of distributing that. And as a consequence, Cuba has the highest literacy rate, one of the highest literacy rates in the world. Everybody attends school free of charge, the school higher education free of charge. Also, as a consequence, Cuba has some of the best doctors and scientists in the world. So clearly, in terms of the educational process, Cuba has done the impossible. One of the things with respect to America, when we started talking about large expenditures toward education, we don't see the results. So that is indicative of the fact that education is more than simply economics. It's a myriad of factors impacting on education. And Cuba has seemed to found that formula in terms of, you know, balancing, you know, resources, you know, with social institutions to create the best human being both personally and intellectually. So I think the audience is very appreciative of the fact that they talk about Cuba's contributions. One of the things medically I just want to point out real quickly is that Cuba has cures for all kinds of diseases. One in particular is for meningitis, in which Cuba freely gives to the world. It doesn't even charge them a cent. Now, in America, in the context of America and this capitalist society, when you start talking about that kind of humanity, it sort of gets lost in translation. People are under the perception that ruthlessness, greed, avarice is the norm. So people with that kind of mindset are hard-pressed to understand are people who are so spirited, are people who are so imbued with humanity that they're willing to give up their technological or medical creations for the good of all humanity. And this is certainly the kind of nation we're striving to build here in America. And this is the kind of nation Cuba, in fact, has. So Cuba is indispensable in terms of you know, being a first-class example, you know, of what humanity can be. And so it's good that people got an opportunity to come out and hear Cuba's contributions to humanity.
Okay, Brother Neil, what was your general overtake of the program?
I thought it was a very excellent program in a number of ways. First, in terms of the audience itself was a broad spectrum of the community. People from a number of different backgrounds were there. You didn't have a narrow, but had a very broad audience. So you had people from a lot of different backgrounds there, and that was very good. I think the cultural piece of the part of the program was very good as well, because you had a positive African culture that was uplifting and good. Now, in terms of the program itself, I think there were a couple of things that really impressed me. One was that we had one young lady there who's had a direct connection to Cuba. Her parents, her mother was from Cuba, and she had done videos. And those videos showed people as everyday people. You get a sense of people who love their families, love their communities, and who love culture. And so we get a sense that it's not the sort of type of thing that the media here sort of demonizes Cuba, but in her videos you see sort of humanism of the Cuban people themselves, and you see their positive and progressive attachment to each other and attachment to their culture and the culture of the people. There was another video from a young lady, again, who had been in Cuba studying medicine, and this was a result of the Cubans themselves offering free medical education to students, many of whom are African students from the U.S. or what some people would refer to as African American, and others. And the only requirement is that when they get back and finish what they have to do, they practice to uplift the people in their communities that need that particular service. And what impressed me about this young lady was the fact that she began her presentation discussing the nature of the neighborhoods and so forth that she had grown up in the United States, where there was quite a bit of crime and violence and these sorts of things, and her own response to that over time was, as she became conscious, was to try to become politically involved, and once she had actually was able to get to Cuba to study medicine, not only was she able to study medicine, but she was also able to see a different type of community. And she came out of a community where there was quite a bit of poverty, and she was going to a country that itself was poor, but it had a different type of system. And because it had a different type of system, you didn't have a kind of a dog-eat-dog mentality, but you had a more of a collectivized, uplifting kind of mentality and consciousness. And she was clearly, by the way, her presentation, clearly enthusiastic about her experience and waiting to come back to her communities to practice medicine and to give of herself in the same way the Cubans have done. Now, one of the, earlier we talked about, Brother Hakeem just mentioned that there had been, Cubans had the highest literacy rates in the world, and they also were the group that got to that literacy rate probably faster than anybody else. But they also have a very excellent health care system that they not only have in that country, but they share this health care system around the world. And you can go to lots of parts of the world and see these Cuban doctors. And so despite the fact that the United States has all of this overwhelming amount of resources, because those resources, like we said earlier, were all skewed to the top, we also have among the masses, some very poor health outcomes. So the U.S. has one of the highest infant mortality rates in the world. And the Cubans, at the same time, have one of the lowest. So a baby born in the United States is much more likely to die at birth than a baby born in Cuba, despite the fact that one country has much fewer resources than the other. But the way those resources are utilized and produced makes all the difference in the world. I think this was kind of important aspect that she pointed out in the program. And I think the discussion was pretty good as well. We had a very good discussion and the discussion between the panel and the community, I think was very good.
There were two things that stood out with me. Well, there was a couple of things that stood out in terms of my participation. And when we were talking about the panel discussion, there was a couple of points that you and Hakeem made that I'd like for y'all maybe articulate just a little bit and share with our listening audience. Well, Hakeem, when you were doing a comparison between the two countries and two systems, you also talk about this issue of how they dealt with the youth. from a class perspective and stuff, can you just speak a little bit on no more about the comparison of the two systems and question of the youth, how you value certain youth lives versus others?
Yeah, I think the one extraordinary thing, which is a result of the social political system in Cuba, is that not only do they understand the value of humanity, but they see it in their children. They understand in terms of, you know, creating the kind of human being that we all should aspire to be. That they understand that first and foremost, it has to emanate from love. And so I think that our point of love directed toward the children is an indication of just how humane the Cuban people is, and it manifests itself in terms of how they interact with their children. One of the things that's particularly discouraging, distressing to even, is that when you look at the treatment or the kind of disdain of so many American parents, non-parents have toward the children, particularly poor children, it gives me cause to pause. This notion, in fact, that because kids are born into, you know, poverty circumstances, that their life, in fact, doesn't mean anything, I think on many, many levels problematic. I think if we contrast that with wealthier kids, there's this unwritten perception that somehow that if the kid's wealthy, they're more deserving of love and more deserving of respect. And it manifests itself in terms of the kind of resources that are giving rich kids relative poor kids. It doesn't make much sense at all that when you talk about kids coming from an impoverished environment, as opposed to enriching the environment to bring the best kid, to create the best child. On the contrary, what we do is we eliminate what meager resources exist for that poor child, which leads that child to a life of frustration, hopelessness, despair. So why would you want to do that, you know, as a country? Why do you literally want to destroy your kids, you know, from a spiritual or psychological level? I think Cuba has understood that, you know, that is not the way in terms of building a healthy, holistic society. And I think it manifests itself in terms of how people treat their children. I think in America, to a large extent, I think we have internalized this notion that some kids are more deserving and some kids are, in fact, intrinsically better than others. I think it's something that the community has to struggle with in terms of this mindset. You know, being impoverished doesn't mean that, you know, that you don't have gifts to give to the world. It doesn't mean that you can't overcome obstacles. But certainly in terms of human development, certain material things are important in terms of, you know, enhancing, you know, child development. Massive poverty, to the extent that it impacts on, you know, what a poor child may eat for breakfast or not eat for breakfast, or just to be privy to ideas, it does have a deleterious impact on the development of the child. And so we have to understand that. So I think Cuba overcomes that obstacle in terms of material deprivation by immense amount of love being, you know, given to the children and the kind of support and love in which the kids feel and they understand exists. So I think in America we got a real problem in terms of this phenomenon, in terms of despair, disdain toward children, particularly poor children. It's something that the adults in the communities have to begin to address.
Okay, excellent point. And for Brother Neil, you made an excellent analogy or historical reference between the support and the interconnection between Cuba and Africa and the struggling Cuban people and the struggling African people. There was an issue between how it has impact when we help Cuba, how does it transcend and help Africa. Can you speak a little bit and share that perspective with our audience? On Cuba,
yeah,
our relationship, how contribute to our struggle and vice versa.
Yeah, the first thing I want to sort of mention that as a Pan Africanist, you know, we believe that all of our people, no matter where we are, all black folks are African. So, and that. In particular, and although our struggle is international, in particular, the sort of central focus really pay attention to what's going on in Africa itself. And so and also we see when we look at the Cuban people themselves, it probably at least, it's one of the figures that someone pointed out at the program, about 60% of the Cuban people themselves are African directly. So now, one of the things that the Cubans have done is really have been consistently involved in some of the most cutting-edge struggles inside of Africa, and I'm going to mention three of them. In the Congo, there was a leader who really led the movement for independence in the Congo, a young man at the time by the name of Patrice Lumumba. And of the three leading parties, his was the only party that was nationalistic, that is, it included all of the people from all around, from all elements inside of the Congo. Later, led by the Belgians, the U.S., other Western imperialists, they overthrew this man, and not only did they overthrow him, but he was killed, he was assassinated, and his body was thrown into a batch of acid, so people wouldn't even remember him. As the people in the Congo attempted to struggle against that and struggle to maintain their independence and progress, this is one of the first times that we began to see the Cubans enter into Africa, and they fought on the side of those folks who were trying to, bring about justice. So that was part of the beginning of the entry of the Cubans into Africa in that sort of way. We also began to see the Cubans playing a big role in Guinea-Bissau, and there they trained many of the forces who were then led by Amilcar Cabral, and they helped to train them and help lay the groundwork for a successful defeat of the Portuguese inside of what we call Guinea-Bissau and Cape Verde. And lastly, probably one of the more critical pieces or parts of this puzzle was the role played in Angola, where the Cubans, along with other Africans, defeated the South African army. And this not only had a big military effect and political effect, it had a great psychological effect, because at that particular time, up until that time, the South Africans were considered to have the baddest army or the strongest army in Africa, at least in southern Africa. And here you have them defeated by these Cubans, and this helped turn the tide inside of South Africa. So one of the things that we see is that throughout Africa, you see the Cubans playing this huge role of a little bitty island with very little money. And even beyond the continent of Africa itself, in the Caribbean, we see the Cubans all throughout the Caribbean. And although they have much less money than U.S., their foreign affairs, their foreign aid equals in dollar numbers what the U.S. Puts out in some of these countries. And we can never forget the role that the Cubans played in Grenada when the Marines came in there and overthrew a government that was brought in by its own people. They came and just overthrew the government, and here the Cubans were helping to defend that island. And these are just guys, craftsmen out there working in the field, and they are putting their lives on the line to defend that country. So that wherever our people have been in the struggle for any kind of justice and freedom and forward movement, the Cubans have been there as well. And it's for these reasons that support of Cuba and support of those people, those Cubans who have been part of that, is very important.
You know, that's to add to your point, Brother Neil, also be careful to get the gesture that the Cuban made during this whole Katrina crisis. They were willing to bring doctors by the thousands to come into a region to assist our brothers and sisters and to be the hospitals on the ground. So in terms of looking at history, we all agree that they have an excellent track record when it comes to exhibiting the love for humanity. And this leads me to the next question. I like how can you respond to. Based on all that we have heard today, I think it is worthy to have a Cuba Appreciation Day and Awareness Day at least once a year within the African community. Because one of the problems that the Cubans are facing today is the problem of propaganda. There are tools in place, machines in place to talk about all of the bad things that may happen or create illusions or misrepresentation of the realities of Cuba and become very difficult for the average citizen in this country to acquire the necessary information based upon truth when it comes to Cuba, because the whole regime here is stacked up to give you an illusion and put you in a position where you cannot even speak on it or to it without so-called being considering the enemy of the state. And I'm saying that in reaction to their refusal just to let their representative come to speak to the various communities who have an interest in terms of this relationship, what impacts them on a daily basis, whether they're conscious of it or not. If the Cubans are not in a position to be able to speak to the people, how will we be able to deal with this foreign policy where there's a blackout or all truthful information as it relates to Cuba? Because what this does is it set our people up to become, to continue to become buffalo soldiers, fight people who have no ill grievance against them, no harm against them. How do we deal with this question of information and propaganda when it comes to Cuba to make sure our people properly understand its relationship as it relates to the well-being of our people? Brother Hackey, then Brother Neil, I'd like for y'all to respond to that.
No, I think it would be appropriate to have a Cuba Awareness or Appreciation Day yearly, precisely for the reasons you articulated. I think it is important that our people understand Cuba's contribution to the community. Unfortunately, a lot of people don't know because of the propaganda that exists. But they're more important than some common people understand the reason why the U.S. continues to attack Cuba. One of the things that Ms. Pence is we often talk about democracy, and when you talk about democracy, how many of us really understand the definition of democracy?
Yeah, in order to adequately understand democracy, then we have to go back to the philosopher Democritus who coined the term democracy. And this notion of democracy is supposed to be, even from a theoretical point, egalitarianistic in terms of the greatest good for the greatest number of people. In other words, policies to affect the will of the citizenry. But that's not what happened. If we go back in the further reason of Democritus, one of the things that he abstained a lot on the notion that poor people should have any control, any type of self-determination over their own life. So as a consequence, his mission was that only the wealthy should benefit from the resources of the land, because the wealthy are particularly, they are not only connected, but they are particularly and infinitely more intelligent than the masses of people. So, oddly enough, when you look at the U.S. Constitution, you look at the preamble, and one of the first things it mentions is republic. That when the legal fact of the United States is a republic, that's precisely what it is. It's not a democracy, it's a republic. In the republic, it is precisely what Democrats have laid out to be. Namely, the Republican is that only the powerful, only the rich should benefit. Everything government does should be for the benefit of the rich, of the powerful. And so the consequence is this situation where wealth is being accrued to the 1% of the population. You understand this is precisely from a systematic point of view the way things before were. Now, when we talk about lack of resources for the masses of people in terms of lack of education, lack of health care, lack of education, lack of food, and so forth, that for the Republic, that's not a problematic issue. Because after all, in a Republic, you don't deserve those kind of things simply because you lack the pedigree in terms of the intelligence to qualify for those kind of things. So this is the thing that we have to understand. So even though the media continues to push this notion that America is a democracy, we hear it all the time, and if you push them far enough, what they'll tell you, no, we're not a democracy, we're a representative democracy. There's all kind of things being perpetuated by the elite, by the powerful, for the sole purpose of deceiving people. Now, Cuba, in its finest sense of the word, we talk about authoritarianism, is more democratic than America. People in the impoverished areas, poor people coming up, are organized and will have committees in which they actually get opportunity to articulate their concern and needs, not only for the community, but for the country at large. And so the consequence, those individuals, many of them rise through the ranks in terms of being able to use the power to impact on Cuba policy. So I think the confusion comes from when people look at Cuba and think that if it doesn't mirror, America, then in fact that somehow it's not democratic. In fact, if you look at the history of America, it's very clear. When you look at the so-called the early presidency, the founding fathers, the thing is that those people weren't beholden to the master of the people. The master of the people had no sense of terms to become president. It was the organized wealthy who determined president, during the colonial era. And that's the process between even today. So often people think that you're actually voting for elected officials. In fact, with the advent of the technology, you're not really voting for your representatives, actually representatives, in the way they're going to format it. They determine who they're going to represent. So we kind of picked this kind of opinion that exists in a country. Leaving a lot of people to be heard in terms of precisely what democracy is. And I think that by highlighting Cuba's contribution to humanity, we underscore the real problem that exists in the system in terms of not being accountable to the people, not being democratic, or not being equitable and fair. And so this is the biggest fear for the ruling class, because anytime any system is revealed, that there are different paradigms that can put into place in terms of providing some news you're fitting to. It becomes an automatic threat to the United States and its elite. And so this is why Cuba is demonized, vilified, and they don't want people to know about Cuba. Something as simple as having representatives even just come and talk to people. All they did is talking. All we're talking about is ideas. My understanding is that ideas are essential in terms of democratic process. But then if you can't have ideas that they even demerit in terms of Cuba, then how legitimate is the claim that ideas are merited? They're not. Not as far as the ruling class is concerned. But this is the dilemma that we're confronted with. This is why it's so important that really we institutionalize Cuba Awareness and Appreciation Day. Because if we're going to move in a more wholesome, more healthy direction, then we have to demonstrate to people that in fact there is their alternative paradigm that exists.
Okay, Brother Neil.
I hope I'm coming across clear because I get a lot of static on my phone here. But one of the things that I want to follow up with Brother Haki is that there are several forms of what people call democracy, and one form of democracy that people talk about in what we call settler colonies, and the U.S. is, I guess, a form of a settler colony where people have come here from other places, is something that they call Herrenvolk democracy where the dominant group, which might be a majority, can pass laws to suppress a group that might be in the minority. So if you go down to Florida where Trayvon Martin was murdered and the guy who killed him was got off based on something called, you know, their interpretation was the Stand Your Ground law, which was passed in democratic means, in a sense, people voted to pass that law. And just because it was done by a lot of people doesn't mean that it was a good thing. The other thing is, when did America become a democracy? The majority of Africans in this country didn't start voting until after the 1965 Civil Rights Act, Voting Rights Act. So it's a question of what is a democracy? When does a country become a democracy? All these kind of things are still not final things. But the big question is, this act of a boycott of a country or embargo of a country is actually an act of war and in many ways illegal and by international law. So that's one of the problems that have to be raised and people have to look at. But the other thing is, a lot of times when you suppress information, really, these things, suppressing this information can come back in your face because you suppress something enough and you hide stuff and people want to wonder what is it all about. So people now become curious. What is it that this little island so small? Why is it that you have to suppress all this information? You actually increase people's wanting to get that information, and so people are more curious now because of this suppression, and that's one of the things that we have to deal with. So I think if in the world again, like Lee was saying, you know, the world is a place where you have different countries and peoples and things like that, and people have to interact with each other, and when you attempt to exclude someone from that one group from that interaction, that can actually blow up in your face, and I'll give you an example. Cuba, there was an attempt to exclude Cuba from by the United States to exclude Cuba from all of the activities of the Americas, you know, the Organization of American States and so forth. But Cuba has become again so effective in terms of what it's doing that more and more countries are coming to even think like the Cubans think. And so now, by attempting to isolate Cuba, the U.S. has actually in some ways isolated itself. So these are the kinds of ways that these kind of activities can actually boomerang. Because once you do a program, the one we did the other day, and people say, okay, well, people weren't allowed to come, then people wonder, well, why weren't they allowed to come? I mean, here's a country that's only a handful of people. I mean, you know, only a few million people. You have no problem, and you have no problem with the Chinese, who are a billion people coming and talking, but this little one you are somehow afraid of. And so that makes people more curious. The other thing is that there's been a history of relationship between the African community and the Cuban community for a long time. I mean, you look at this whole idea, the cultural idea of Afro-Cuban music. Cuba used to normally play in the Negro League. So there are people in our community who remember relationships and who and people remember when Malcolm, when Fidel and those folks, they wouldn't let them in any of the big hotels downtown, and they went up to stay in the hotel in Harlem. And so people remember these kinds of things. So there's been forged over time an understanding, a people-to-people understanding that goes beyond these big media and that people-to-people understanding is, I think, at the level of where we continue to do what we do to forge this kind of thing. And one last thing, there is a I'll stop right there.
Yeah, no, I just say that one other thing in terms of your example, we never can forget when you're talking about political leadership in the 60s, 70s, or whenever, even today, whenever they was in trouble, they always could find refuge in Cuba. So,
right.
As you alluded to, the history speaks for itself. What we're going to do right now, we're going to open up our phone line. We'd like any listening audience, anyone in the audience listening to Africa on the Move today who would like to speak to the subject matter that we are discussing, Cuba, its relationship to the African community, and why we should be in solidarity with Cuba. We'd like you to call in, and remember when you call in, make sure you hit one if you have a statement to make or a question. Make sure you hit one, and we will acknowledge your last four numbers in your telephone. So right now, let's go and take a caller. All right, we can go with caller number 4298, caller 4298. Welcome to Africa on the Move. I believe this is Brother Moses.
Good evening, Brother Moses, Brother Robert Moses. I've been listening, and it's as usual, you're instructive and educational, and I particularly like the three struggles, the key struggles in Africa, because those struggles is why the word, as Gil Scott Heron said, what's the word? Johannesburg. Freedom ain't nothing but a word. And basically the word was communism, and they was trying to stamp out communism, and anybody who said they was a communist was a clear and present danger. And but the chickens did come home to roost, and that's why President Kennedy, the high sheriff, is no longer with us. And I guess President Johnson did do the war on poverty, so that was sort of a progressive move in some ways. We reap what we sow. And right now, Obama is got signature drone killings, blowing up weddings, whatever, collateral damage. Now, he's responsible. His signature saying he's responsible and he's willing to be held accountable. And with these war criminals, we're going to have to stay on top of them.
Okay, thank you, Brother Moses. We'll put you on hold. Let's go to our next caller. We are calling 9047. Caller 9047. Welcome to Africa on the Move.
Question, yeah, assalamu alaikum, brother. This is Sheikh.
Who's this?
That's Sheikh. This is Sheikh.
Okay,
from Senegal.
Good, good.
I'm
how
fine,
you doing?
My brother. I'm good, very good. So I have to really thank you, sir, for putting up that program, because you gave us really an opportunity to learn a lot from Kilo, because it was a lot of things that we did not know, and we had really realized, and I wish we can have those kind of programs more often. So you said once a year, I believe I can do with that. And it is a lot of other things that we need to cover when it comes to that. We have like countries like Zimbabwe, North Korea, and other countries that we don't know much about, and we have been filled by, with some information that we cannot really trust. So I believe it was a good move from your part to organize such a forum on Cuba. And we learned a lot, and it is a lot of things we need really to emphasize, because from the forum and from this today's debate, you're talking about Cuba achieving as a very small island and isolated by a lot of countries, a lot of strong countries, came to achieve some lofty things like having the highest rate of literacy. You know, this is not something similar. This is a very lofty matter. And having also the best health care system for this poor and tiny island. And when you say that the population of Cuba is mostly African, I believe this is really the biggest gift that Cuba gave to the African world. You don't see anything like that either in Africa, nor here in America, or in Britain, or in France. So that is really something that you cannot see nowhere in the African world except in Cuba. You know, the only country that has something kind of, you know, following suit is like Zimbabwe, where they have 97% of for rate of literacy, you know. But other than that, it is nowhere in the African world that you can find something that can even close. So I believe this is really the best gift that Cuba has given to the African world. Now, the other brother was talking about all those wars where Cuba went to Africa to help. When they went to the Congo, to Angola. But I also wanted to say that Cuba also went to North Africa. And I believe as far as having a military intervention, it was the first time they did it in Africa, because they had the National Front for Liberation of Algeria fight in the
1990s. You're actually correct, Chick. I agree with you. But go ahead, continue.
Please. Yeah, because they fought over there since 1955 with the attack of the post of Setif in Algeria. And Cuba, when they began that fight, Cuba was not free yet. They were also fighting in Cuba. In 1959, Cuba got free. And they accumulated a lot of experience. And they said that their duty to share their experience with Algeria. And they sent some soldiers to Algeria, some well-trained soldiers to Algeria to help out. Not only they fought alongside the militants of Algeria, but they also airlifted a lot of wounded soldiers, Algerian soldiers, to Cuba to give them a proper medical treatment and send them back to Algeria. So that is, I believe, something that needs also to be mentioned, because it was the first intervention of Cuba in Africa alongside the African people for their freedom. So, really, when I went to the forum on Wednesday, I've been thinking, and I came up with three elements, three substantial elements when it comes to Cuba. The first one would be like freedom. Freedom. They fought all the way, you know, to regain their freedom. And they built, the second element, they built the country based on self-reliance.
Mm-hmm.
That is the second element, the second substance. And the third substance, all the time that they've been building their country, they've been in solidarity with the oppressed world, the oppressed people in the world. So those three elements, freedom, self-reliance, and solidarity, these are really what I believe Cuba has given to the world, to the oppressed people at large.
And I would say all that common under one idea which they believe in, in which they believe in dearly, that's socialism. They are not willing to compromise or change any. They believe socialism is the future for all of humanity. And they are the lead exponent at this point in time in laying that foundation. What I would like to do right now, we only have less than 9 minutes left for this program. It's a special program. The means of trying to get information out to our people and to the world for the real reality of Cuba and our appreciation of Cuba. On the 13th of August, we have a Cuban Appreciation Day. and a Cuba Appreciation Awareness Day held in Richmond, Virginia, at the Wesley Memorial United Methodist Church, 1720 McKenneville Pike, Richmond, Virginia. And it was such a unique program. It was a program that had a special need, particularly as it relates to African people and all those oppressed. Yet there was at least a decision at the program to continue this as an institution. We want to build this and make this an institution that takes place in all of the African communities. But Cuba is worthy of that. We must show our appreciation for all the things that they have done and continue to do for Africa, African people, and humanity. Now, we have a few minutes left, but I would like to state this for the record so other people who will know who made this possible. We must give praise and thanks to the various organizations, from the All African Peoples, Revolutionary Empire of D.C., to the Pan-African, to the Pan-African Unity Movement, to the African Awareness Association, who was the host, as well as individuals such as Brother Hackey, Brother Neil, Brother Chick, Brother Kamal Bismar of the AAPIPGC. It was the keynote presenters, as well as some of the features of films we saw. One of the films produced by Sister Sandy Walker. Another one was a film that Brother Lee Robinson produced, where he interviewed Lydia Holloway, who is a graduate student from Elon School of Landmark. So, in that regard, we'd like to thank all of those. And last but not least, we must give a special praise to Brother R.M. Hunter. He's the pastor of Wesley Memorial Methodist Church. Him and his church for allowing us to host such a program there. And to all of our cultural artists who participated, Iman Shabazz, Nafara, Ron Bagat, and Jacqueline Cole, they were our cultural artists. Also, we have a sister, Jacqueline Cole. They were our cultural artists who helped make this a beautiful, beautiful program. All praises go to all of them and the public that came out, which was alluded to earlier, that this program took how diverse it was as a mix of the African community here. We have a few minutes left, and then we'll come with a closing. We have two callers who've been waiting. They may want to say something. We go to caller 4381. Your question statement, caller 4381. Welcome to Africa on the Move. Yes, caller
4381. Okay, we were just listening today at the good information and taking notes. So thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's have a little sister hand for those who are not knowing. Okay, now, what we need to do right now, we got to equal y'all in the closing statement. Oh, we got to make one statement. We must talk a little bit about the Cuban Five. Start with you, Brother Neil, then Brother Hakeem. What can we do? First of all, who is Cuban Five? What can we do to help them out? You're free to Cuban Five. Brother Neil?
Well, okay. Yeah, the Cuban Five, I think, is a very important program that we have to that we have to support. These are brothers who are now locked down in U.S. prisons. I think three of them are still in. And they were part of the group that were involved in the fighting in against South Africa. That's one of the things we have to remember. At the same time that the United States was supporting the South African government and even sending and helping the South Africans send Nelson Mandela into prison and so forth, these young men were putting their lives on the line to defend the people of South Africa and to assist them in their struggle for freedom. So now they are in prison in the U.S. And I want to mention one thing while we're talking about the Cuban Five. Is that there was a report that just came out just day before we did the program. And this program and that report said that the United States had gotten these young kids from some other South American countries to have them to attempt to go into Cuba
to sow some seeds of disruption. They were like paying them like minimum wages and so forth to even to do these things. And the Cuban people themselves were very alert when they hear these kind of contradictory messages, and they found these folks, and they exposed them. So the U.S. is unrelenting in this attempt to overturn the progress of Cuba. And the arrests and the continued detention of the Cuban Five is part of that. So this is something that these are individuals who had come into the country, who were attempting to see what was going on, some of the things that were going on in the Cuban community here. Many of the Cubans who had come after the revolution were themselves some people who had really bad politics, and some of these folks have been in opposition to the African community in the U.S., particularly in Florida. They have fought against our progress in Africa. They have, in many ways, so they were coming to kind of get a sense of what was going on, and they have been locked up by the U.S. government, and we should we should support their liberation and freedom from these U.S. prisons.
Brother Haki, can you give us at least a 2 minute response on the Cuban Five? Brother Haki?
The only thing I would say, I would encourage people to write Attorney General Holder strongly requesting that those brothers be released so they can return home to Cuba, receive a hero's welcome, which they deserve. I think it's important that people understand the case of the Cuban Five, understand that the injustice inflicted upon them brothers by no means is relegated only to them, but in fact political prisoners, you know, throughout America and throughout the world. So we have to understand that we have a vested interest in terms of fighting this injustice, because today is the Cuban Five, tomorrow it could be you. So it's important that we fight injustice.
Okay, in closing, I think we should end this program with this particular response from Cuba. We got this response from Cuba based upon the State Department denying our right to participate in this program. And I think it's a beautiful response in terms of Cuba's position as it relates to African community. They wrote back to the African Women Association, the people in Richmond, and they stated that, "My dear brothers and sisters, it is with deep sorrow I'm writing to you for saying at least a few words of what I should have told in person. Sadly, forces beyond our will prevented me to attend this Cuba Appreciation Awareness Day. But I can assure nothing stands in the way of my deepest love, respect, and gratitude for all of you. Today is a very special day for all Cubans of goodwill and our friends around the world. Today is the 88th birthday of a living legend, the man who had the ability to unite all Cuban revolutionary forces, the leadership to lead them to victory, the ability to build an inclusive society full of opportunities for all, and goodness to shame it with the needed reach everywhere in the world that man is Fidel Castro. The same Fidel that stayed at Teresa Hotel in Harlem back in 1960 because he knew he could have the heart of the community. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk and learn about Cuba. Thanks so much for your solidarity. I particularly would like to thank my brother, Lee Robson, and the African Women Association, Inc., for making this program possible. Together, we witnessed the end of the nonsense policy that intends to set us apart. We have ways more links which make us stronger. Therefore, we prevail no matter what and struggle. Alexandra V. Rodriguez Salazar, Secretary, of the Cuban intersection. That was their response and statement to us. On a note, we'd like to thank everyone for allowing Africa on the Move to come to your home this evening, and we would like to make acknowledgement of one of the other cultural artists to participate in this program with Brother Ron Bagot. But again, we thank you. Cuba is not an enemy. They are our friends. Just ideas must be supported by just principles. Brothers and sisters, the world needs Cuba. We need to, and Cuba need the world. Let's unite and help each other to make a better humanity for all people. Viva Cuba. Viva socialism. Viva the Cuban Revolution. Viva the people. Until next time, let's strive to go forward ever, backwards never, and we too to say happy birthday also to our brother Fidel. Until next time, we see you, Africa on the Move.
Latitude zero, longitude zero, planned by the Creator. Sesanthropus was the first man found on the earth. That earth was the motherland, Africa. We know that without total understanding of what happened in the past, it would be difficult to relate to the future. We know that within the structure of the music, there should be a message, and the message should be truth. So now, we give you Africa, the center of the world.